We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
What's up, y'all? It's Drewski, and I've teamed up with Mountain Dew to produce a hilarious new basketball podcast called The Dew Zone with Drewski. Learn the backstories of your favorite ballers and celebrities like Jamal Murray.
Did you have like a favorite team? Was it the Raptors at the time or no? Was the Raptors even started around that time?
Come on, bro.
I ain't that old, fam. You're talking like I'm 50.
Taylor Rooks, Asia Wilson, and many more. You won't want to miss this. Listen to The Dew Zone with Drewski on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
And welcome to In the Know, the Hornets 24/7 podcast. Your knowledgeable hosts are Michael McNamara.
Me and a grizzly bear, I'm betting on me.
And me, Ryan Schwan.
I've been playing some Dungeons & Dragons because I'm really cool like that.
Let's get it started. All Hornets, all the time.
Welcome to the show. It's been a long time since we've had one of these, and there's been a lot of stuff that's gone on in the NBA. Today I'm joined by Michael McNamara, as always, and then 42, Jason Calmes, whatever you'd like to call him, 420-foot Jesus at one time or another. He is joining us, talked about the CBA. He has been hip-deep in news all summer long, keeping everybody posted on what was going on, and has a lot to let us know about the new CBA and all the different pieces and parts of it. Today we're doing a special semi-Thanksgiving-ish podcast where each of us are going to take one of the parties to the CBA and tell us why they should be thankful for the contents. Michael and Jason, how are you guys been?
I know I'm doing good. I'm glad the NBA's back. At least it looks that way.
I'm all right.
Not as optimistic as us, but I think we'll turn them around by the end of this podcast.
Somehow he thinks it's still going to crash and burn, but I refuse to allow that to enter my line of thinking yet. So, the CBA, they came to an agreement now two nights ago, and it looks like everybody is now working on getting all the requisite signatures after the NBA union actually gets its act together and puts itself back together, because they literally have to reincorporate. And then once that's done, then they can start signing documents leading up to December 9th, which is probably the most exciting date on my calendar at the moment. That will be the day training camps and free agency opens. And, of course, the first games will commence on Christmas itself as a wonderful Christmas present to all of us NBA junkies out there.
I mean, you just said something that just made me think. I'll share a little something because, you know, I like embarrassing myself. Like, we're about to discuss the CBA, and I don't know about you guys, but when I saw the terms of it, I saw that there was a Twitter post saying, here's the terms of the new agreement. It's pretty early in the morning. I'm sitting here, I'm watching, you know, I'm looking at the computer in my bed, and I just got so excited about it like a kid on Christmas. Went downstairs, I'm reading over it, getting all excited. The wife came down. She thought I was looking at something else on the computer, and when I told her that I was just reading over the details of the tentative deal made with the players, she was actually more disappointed in me than if I had been looking at what she had initially thought I was looking at when she came down. So it's been little little story about me.
Are you actually saying you masturbated to the CBA?
Mentally, I did. Like, by the time I got to to section 14, which I'm sure I'm going to rave about at some point this week, like I was sleepy.
Oh, put it that way.
So
if you read it left-handed, it feels like you're cheating.
Yeah, I put my reader on and everything. It was a good moment. So anyway, so I know at least I and probably Jason even more thoroughly than me, and I'm sure Ryan have gone through this step by step, but we'll try not to make it too boring.
Right. So I'm a little speechless at the moment.
No, it's all right. I just I think I just went again. Anyway.
I heard
it, section 14.
When you started, I actually was like, "Yeah, I was gonna chime in and say, yeah, I felt the same way, but no, I didn't feel the same way."
You didn't finish? Okay. All right, but let's go ahead. Where were you at? I'm sorry to go off tangent. I was so excited to read this, and I'm looking at it again now, and it just.
All right. So, anyways, the deal itself, there is no way you can look at this deal and not recognize that the owners made some very significant gains. So the very first group that we're going to talk about, the owners, and what they should be thankful for in this CBA, we're going to let Michael, who, if he's not too sleepy, we'll let him start and talk about what he thinks in this deal is particularly masturbatory worthy for the owners.
So the two things that I think that the owners, every owner's happiest about is obviously the BRI split, which we've probably heard way too much about over these past couple of months, but we all know that was reduced from 57% to between 49 and 51, depending on how, you know, how each given year goes. And then also there's just so many things in this system that essentially keep owners from harming themselves, as we've seen time and time again in the NBA. Beyond that, I guess you're talking about two different groups of people and what they're thankful for. David Stern went on and on and on about how the owners were united, are united, whatever you want to believe. But obviously, if competitive balance was an issue, you know, there was two different camps in this fight, the haves and the have-nots. The have-nots, you know, wanted to claw their way back up to that mountain, and the haves didn't want to, I guess, have true parity in this league. Otherwise, we would have seen things like a hard cap, or at least a harder push from the owners for a hard cap. So the bigger markets, you know, are thankful that the penalties for the tax levels, the tax rate penalties aren't going to be implemented in these first 2 years. So the Lakers, for instance, are already at $91 million. You know, when it comes to their cap, their luxury tax penalties would have been insane if they had started right away.
Yeah, I think I saw somewhere they would have been paying like $140 million if they kicked it right away.
They simply wouldn't have been able to do it. Same with, I don't know if you guys saw a couple weeks ago, Tyson Chandler basically made a statement saying that he doesn't believe that under these new rules, the Mavs will be able to resign him. Dallas will actually have a couple of years to get their books together and probably will be able to bring back, their title team with improvements. You know, the Rudy Fernandez trade that they made. So the big market teams, I think, are excited that the really bad penalties don't kick in for 2 years. The smaller market clubs, I think, just have to be satisfied with the fact that, no, this is not ideal, but it's better in a lot of ways. You know, the penalties are going to be so bad by year three that I really don't see, you know, you definitely won't see the gap that we saw the last couple of years between the big markets and the small markets. So I guess it's different things depending on what owner you are, but I think every single owner won in this fight. I know the Hornets don't have an owner, but if and when, you know, we get that person in the next couple of months, they're obviously going to be much happier with this set of rules. I guess if we're going to talk about things that you're not thankful for with this new deal, I would say that universally, the owners obviously would have had liked to have higher percentage of the BRI and perhaps some other issues that would have kept spending down, but they had beaten the players so bad in this battle that I think that they've got to be happy with what they have right now. But I guess the more I think about it, it's a complicated question because it really would depend on which owner you're talking to as far as exactly what they'd be thankful for.
Right. So, small market owners, are there any things in the CBA that should make them extremely excited, or are they still? I mean, we haven't seen anything about what the revenue sharing agreements really are, and we've said in past podcasts that that's really key to what, you know, making those small markets viable. But is there anything in this proposed outline that we can see that small market owners should just be like really excited about? Because I'm not sure I see anything that, you know, makes their lives that much easier.
So I guess it's two different questions. Now let's imagine there was no system ever in place. This is the first year of a CBA somehow, and the small market owners had the previous system on the table and this one. How happy would they be that this one was chosen over the previous, right? So if you compare it to what they've been working with in the past, I think they're ecstatic. Now, if you compare it to what ideally small market owners would want, you know, they're going to say, well, I wish we could have had this too, and I wish we could have had that too. So I guess it depends on what lens you're looking at this through. I think in the last collective bargaining agreement, a small market team would have to bat between 900 and 1,000 to win the championship. I mean, or a team that wasn't willing to go well above the tax. You look at San Antonio, you just happened to get maybe the best number one pick in the last, you know, 15 years. You happen to strike on two international guys. The Detroit Pistons made every single right move over a course of a couple of years. So you would just have to be phenomenal, while a team like the Lakers could miss on two or three deals and still be able to cover their asses with money.
Or the Mavericks.
The Mavericks. Yeah, the Mavericks could just keep taking a shot at, okay, we'll give this guy a $30 million contract this year and see if he, you know.
Right.
And then eventually one of their shots, Tyson Chandler, pays off and they win a title. So they have more bullets in the chamber. I think that this narrows the gap. I think a small market team or a team not willing to overspend can bet 750 and a large market team bet 600, you know, to win a title. So I don't think it's ideal. I think that it makes it much more likely that we could see Pistons-like championship teams. I think the big megastars are almost always going to want to go to big markets. And I think the only thing that you could have done to prevent that is to take the limit off of maximum salaries. It sounds like that was never on the table. So I don't think that the small markets are in any better situation to keep the megastars. I think they're in a lot better situation to, I think we're going to see more Pistons teams in small market areas. I think we could see 8, 9, 10 deep teams of very solid players. Now, that did absolutely nothing for the Nuggets last year, but, right, you know, I think we could see better team basketball overall with this. But, you know, Hornets fans are 100% about keeping their superstar. This CBA doesn't do that, but I think it does a lot of things, you know, for small market teams to have some advantages in you know, keeping the Wilson Chandlers of the world, right, off of the bed. So,
well, I mean, and we'll talk, just because you brought it up, we'll talk more about Chris Paul later in the week. We're going to have a series of podcasts here for all those of you listening. So we will definitely address Chris Paul and what the CBA means for us and him later in the week. I guess we'll need to move on now. So you know, the CBA was a negotiation between players and owners, and pretty much fans got crapped on. They didn't get a say, and they essentially got ignored. Neither side really even mentioned the fans while they were talking about, you know, BRI splits and system issues and how each side is disrespecting the other, and how one side are plantation owners and one side are pampered idiots. So take us through what should fans be thankful for, Jason, in this particular deal?
Yeah, so I'll do my best impression of normal in the next few minutes. just casual observation and studies both show that what fans really like is complexity and movement, right? The fans like to dream about what the team can be. This CBA gives them that, right? They like player movement. This CBA gives them that, right? People can still dream about acquiring 2-3 superstars, and there's lots of cap exceptions, extended trades, signing trades, all these mechanisms to do that. And so that's what fans want, and that's what they have here. They don't care what the BRI split is, right? They just care about fitting the salary, whatever it is, into some magic formula, right? And now you're going to have a mix of, like, old deals and new deals, right? Then you have the phase-in period, right? So this, and from that point of view, this CBA is a gift that keeps on giving, right? Because starting on the 9th, there's going to be a set of rules that's different from last year's. And then 2 years, or a year and a half from the 9th, basically, there's going to be a different set that kicks in, right? And then there's an opt-out after 6 years, so 4 years after that. So so I think that's important for the NBA as a whole in terms of keeping fans interested and keeping people talking. Because, I mean, as soon as this thing was proposed, not accepted, immediately, how can we get Dwight Howard? How can we keep Chris Paul? David West is gone. I think we want West and Landry. Boom, 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 boom. Right? We had a lockouts week worth of traffic in a couple hours. These are all the things, for instance, that a lot of the players were pushing for, the system issues. And the owners getting together on that, allowing the tax teams to have certain exceptions, use of those things, $4 million over the tax. That is important, right? That increases the market, increases the number of bidders, it increases the possibility. And for fans, they can dream, right? Now, depends on what team you're a fan of, right?
Right.
In terms of what you're dreaming of. The other thing, like you said, Mike, was that I think more teams, you're going to see more teams pushing deeper into the playoffs on a frequency basis. So the Bucks are probably going to make deeper runs into the playoffs than they had before, right? Clearly the same number of teams are in the playoffs, but some of the perennial stuff is going to drop out. Whether those top teams who are rich and well-managed and all those other things that can still outspend people step aside and give up their dominance is yet to be seen. But I think people are going to have more of those division champ banners distributed throughout the NBA rather than collected in Boston or whatever.
Now, how do you think fans feel about the fact that, the one thing different in this sport than football is NBA contracts are guaranteed, and there was a lot of threats of the owners, possibly either rolling back contracts or canceling fully guaranteed contracts in this new CBA, but Section 8 says salary guarantees remain exactly the same. There'll be no limitations on a player's ability to receive 100% guaranteed salary in all seasons of a contract. How do fans feel about that? How should they?
I mean, overall, I think they should feel good. That's me. You want you know, your team to do well, right? You want your GMs to be held accountable and think about all their decisions, I mean, the consequences they're going to have to live with. And if a brash team somewhere else doesn't do that, right, you believe your team is better, then that helps you, right? If you're just counting on people overspending and stuff like that, and you're not too really sure about your management, maybe you're not a big fan of it. But overall, I think the salary guarantee takes a certain casual nature out of the business of trades.
Okay.
And free agency. Maybe not the way everybody feels, but I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, the only piece about it that I've never been a huge fan of is it always seems inevitable that, I mean, these contracts are still 4 years. It always seems pretty inevitable that a player will sign a big contract and his next year just isn't that impressive.
Yep. I agree. And I would say that's the, you know, fault of the people writing the checks. That's
right.
You know, I mean, that's, you're talking about somebody's character there, you know, and I mean, what you don't want, so let's turn it around. Let's say you have Kyrie Irving, right? So you're Cleveland, right? So, or let's go back to the Clippers, Blake Griffin, right? Mm-hmm. He gets hurt against us in preseason, right? Well, if you have the ability to cut him and go sign somebody else or something like that, maybe he's on a rookie deal, but which makes the financial impact a lot less, but you cut him and let him go somewhere else to help yourself right now, and then he goes somewhere and goes crazy, you know, like he is.
Right. There's always that opposite side of the guaranteed contracts that people always forget, which, you know, you've locked that player in and they're pretty much yours. So, I mean, when you got, like you said, Blake Griffin or even say Chris Paul,
yeah,
you know, they're not going anywhere.
So the other thing is, I mean, look at what this, I mean, you know, if you don't read what I write, you don't know it, but I hate Dallas, right? yet I like Tyson Chandler a good bit. I have a lot of respect for the man. I have a lot of love for the man. You know, his guaranteed deal is what kept him in the mix for that title. You know, as far as I'm concerned,
right?
Because I mean, he was hurt and gimpy, and there was all this stuff coming out. And you know, was he impressive in Charlotte? No. You know, lots of people, you know, said he was done, whatever. If you could have cut him, and then maybe he would have got not that deal, but a larger deal somewhere else, larger than what someone would have offered him, Gimpy, right? He would have got a $6 million deal somewhere else when Dallas or someone might have only offered him a $3 million deal. But all these machinations keep these players up, you know? I think that's a good thing. There's a downside to it if you're wrong, but it makes for wonderful stories, and Tyson's a wonderful story.
All right.
Well, so we got those two. Now I guess you've been kind of avoiding it. I think you're stalling, Ryan, to try to come up with what the players should be happy about after being beaten practically to death by the owners in this deal. Maybe not as bad as a lot of people wanted to see, but they owners definitely came on top when you compare it to the last deal. But you're going to get to play NBA basketball in a couple of weeks. With regard to this deal, what are you, the players, thankful for?
Well, I mean, and I mean, Jason even said this when we were talking offline at one point. You know, there's all this stuff about how, you know, the BRI, the players clearly got beaten down by it. They, you know, gave up essentially 7%. If you figure that out for a $4.1 billion revenue stream, which is what, you know, that equates to, 7% is about $290 million, which is kind of $10 million short of what the owners claimed they were losing every year. Now, I don't believe the owners' numbers. I don't believe that they actually lose $300 million because there's all kinds of incidental income. And, of course, selling these franchises makes most of them a lot of money. But basically, the two sides went to the table and one side was declaring outright, we are not giving in because we are losing lots of money. And the players have no leverage in this deal at all. It's not like there's this huge demand out there that they have to play right now. The players have they didn't put any sort of effort out there early on to say, we're going to decertify and sue you for being a monopoly and take antitrust lawsuits against you. They had no leverage really at all when they hit the table. And they ended up basically giving up $280 million to the owners per year. So basically, they agreed to pay the cost, and they weren't raked over the coals. I mean, yeah, you can say that they lost because, you know, they were locked out and there was all the hardline talk going on. But even if you look at the system issues, they're still going to get paid. That's the whole thing that's funny, is they still get paid the same amount. They're getting 50% regardless of what the system issues are. And those system issues allow them to move around just the exact same way they were before, which was what they were fighting for. So in the end, the players essentially have almost the exact same system that they had before. And they ended up basically giving up a reasonable amount of money, which would enable their partners to become profitable again. I don't necessarily see that as getting your butt kicked.
Okay, but so we're talking about being thankful. Is there any group of players that should be more thankful, or I guess less thankful? Is there a specific group of players that might lose in this deal?
So we're going to break into this little side conversation we've had before. We're gleeful about this, all three of us, Jason, Mike, and I. I'm going to bring this up now. There is a group of players who should be really, really, really upset by this deal. And it's not actually the big superstars. The superstars actually got a little tiny piece in there. There's a thing called the designated max player that each team can have. If you've hit certain benchmarks, you've been an MVP, an all-star starter a couple times, or been on an all-NBA team, I think, twice, you are able to be a designated player, a max player, and earn up to 30% of the salary cap, which is more than what you could earn before. So the superstars actually got a little bit of a raise out of this, but there are all of those really horribly overpriced veterans. The Rip Hamiltons, Rashard Lewis, Gilbert Arenas, these guys who are making way more money than they should have even made during their prime in a lot of ways. Those guys were all lined up to be amnestied, take their money and run, and go say, hey, Miami Heat, hey, Chicago, hey, all those big teams, you know, that are all contending, I'll come sign with you for the veteran minimum like Michael Finley did for the San Antonio Spurs back in the last amnesty clause, because I just want to win, and I'm already got paid, so I don't really care. Well, those guys are screwed because of this really, really clever piece in this deal. And since Michael, I think this is actually the part that just finished him earlier. Would you like to explain it to everybody?
Section 14. Yeah, what got me so excited about this is I never give the NBA any credit for any kind of imagination in any of these deals. I mean, I think I've said before, I'm a fan of Bill Simmons, at least his podcasts, and he has some crazy ideas from time to time, but he has some ones that would make the league far more interested. I mean, a play-in series for the eighth seed is one of his ideas that I think would be fascinating. It would make me actually care at the beginning of the playoffs. But, you know, he has great ideas. The NBA never does anything, you know, creative or fun. It's kind of, well, let's take what we used to do and then just tweak it a bit. The amnesty, they completely did something different. So the old amnesty, the way it would work is a team would just amnesty the player, basically get rid of that player, get their numbers off the books, but still play their full salary. And like Ryan would say, these people would say, okay, well, I'm getting paid $24 million a year from an employer that, you know, I don't work for anymore. So I'll, you know, I'll just go to a situation that I, you know, will be comfortable in. I'll go to a championship contender, and whatever they pay me is just gravy because I'm already getting my old contract. Well, I think if that would have happened now, you know, we've already seen the rumors of Baron Davis wanting to go to the Lakers, or the Lakers interested in Rashard Lewis, or the Bulls picking up Rip Hamilton the second he gets amnestied. It's not going to work that way this time. How it's going to work is if a team chooses to amnesty someone, let's, for this example, use Rashard Lewis. The Wizards say, all right, we want him completely off our books. We choose to amnesty Rashard Lewis. What's going to happen is there's going to be a waiver process in which all 29 teams have the opportunity to put in a bid for Rashard Lewis. They'll say, okay, he has 3-4 years left on the deal, whatever. Over those 4 years, I would be willing to pay $16 million. Now, let's say that team wins by having the highest bid. Now, Rashard Lewis has to go to that team. He doesn't get to just cherry pick his options. That team is now paying Rashard Lewis $4 million a year, which is probably closer to his value. And essentially, that $16 million total gets taken off of what the Wizards owe. So the team that's cutting this player, who essentially, you know, they're paying to get rid of, they don't have to take the full bite. Team B could get a value by picking up Rashard Lewis, and Rashard Lewis doesn't get to cherry pick his team. So I just think that was a brilliant way to do the amnesty, because I think if they would have done it the old way, you would have just seen a flood of these guys going to the contenders, making them stronger at a, you know, at a value price. And really all the teams that have been managing their books well would have been sitting there, you know, saying, how does this benefit me at all? I'm not saving money by getting rid of a guy, and I'm not getting to, you know, have a fair shot at the at a Brandon Roy when he comes onto the market because he just wants to go to a winner or a big city, whatever. So I just thought that was an absolute stroke of brilliance. I think it opens so many doors for multiple teams, Hornets included, because you have the right to put in a waiver only if you're not a tax team, which the Hornets obviously won't be as we roll into December 9th. So they could put in claims on Brandon Roy. You know, they could say, we'll pay him $3 million a year. If they get him, that's a great value with very low risk. If they don't get him, you know, then oh well. But they don't have to worry about him going to back up Kobe in L.A. or to be the starting shooting guard for Dallas for pennies on the dollar.
Right.
So actually, Michael, the clause it's written says room under the cap.
Room under the cap, I'm sorry, not a tax team. So room under the cap, again, the Hornets will be a team under the cap.
Well, it's a significant difference because there are fewer teams under the cap than there are under the tax.
Right,
so
yeah.
So it makes the likelihood that you get a better player higher.
Right. As of right now, there are already 10 teams that are over the salary cap. The Knicks, the Bulls, the Mavericks, the Heat, the Hawks, the Trailblazers, Celtics, Spurs, Magic, and Lakers. So those are a lot of the teams we're talking about. None of those teams would be, you know, if Portland amnesties Brandon Roy, you know, right away, none of those teams would be able to put in a bid. We're talking about teams that actually need the talent that would be able to put in the bid and win his services.
Yeah, and when you factor in cap holds and things like that, you know, it becomes a pretty targeted process, I think.
Right. Yeah, December 9th through the 16th, 7th, whatever, that week is going to be fascinating. What we kind of go to show is that nobody absolutely kills on this deal. You know, everybody has a little bit of something to be thankful for. As I've heard it put a couple times and I think is right, you don't really want to make a deal that somebody's happy with. But instead something that all sides could live with. And I think that's the case here. I guess my final question going out to this is, in 1999 and even 2005, every analyst, expert, talking head like us would have said that the owners killed the players in the new CBA. You know, they came out the winner in 99, they came out the winner in 2005, and yet as history played out, we see that several years later, the owners are whining because they got a bad deal. I'm going to kind of ambush you guys with this. I don't know if you thought about it. We didn't talk about discussing this, but my question to you is, sell me on a scenario or tell me how it happened if 6 years from now the owners are opting out of this deal because it's absolutely horrible for them.
I would, if they continue to spend way more money that they bring in. You wipe out some people's debt, they build it back up immediately, right? So are the teams gonna continue to make, they're gonna bring in these owners that are cash strapped, like Morello, right? There was a problem there. I mean, if you continue to bring in and harbor bad owners for a long time, you're gonna try to fix it any which way you can. And coming back to the player well may be a way that they do that. In terms of inside this deal, you know, not having 47%, their reset fake offer thing, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, the one situation I could see where they would be losing money and start screaming and crying again is if they try to do something stupid, like actually put a division in Europe, like they've been saying off and on, or in China. I mean, maybe China's not as dumb as it once was, but, I mean, basically they are losing money in their overseas ventures as it is. So if they expand those efforts, then they will probably start crying again. But other than that, I can't really think of a whole lot of situations.
Yeah, and I'm sure that in 99 when they were proclaimed winners, we wouldn't have been able to think of ways. Let me try to sell you on this, because this is the only way that I think. But what if a history repeats itself scenario comes up of, okay, the Hornets are a prime example. This new CBA is done, and now this team is for sale. The owners, it looks like, just won huge on the CBA, so the Hornets' price is going to be inflated. What winds up happening is in the next 6 years, we see 10, 12, 14 new owners coming in, buying these teams for much more than they're worth at present time, thinking that this new CBA will essentially be a cash cow for them. And then they're sitting there 6 years from now because they had bought in so high, saying, well, we're not, you know, turning the profit that we expect. We want a 55%, 57% BRI split. Is there any way that happens? Because it's essentially, you know, what we heard about with this new group of owners being the ones that were so frustrated with this deal and weren't really listening to Stern. They had bought in high. And they weren't happy with just breaking even. They wanted to have a guaranteed profit. Well, if they bought in high, what do you think people are going to start buying in with now after, you know, the NBA has a more friendly CBA for owners?
Yeah, and one of the major points of contentions about the owner's number was always that they were including the amortization of the value of the franchise and making payments on purchasing it into that loss. Which, you know, you can argue either way. I'm not an accountant. So, yeah, I mean, that's completely conceivable if there's suddenly a run on NBA teams from crazy one percenters.
Which will bring us to our next podcast where I think the next one, what are we going to be discussing?
Ownership.
Okay.
Yeah. All right, so thanks, everybody, for listening to us. Jason, you got anything else you wanted to talk about real quick?
No.
And I won't let Mike say any more because I'm sure he'll come up with some crazy-ass closing statement he's been thinking about all summer.
Chris Paul, later in the week.
I just want to deprive him of that in this podcast. So I'll let him do it later.
All right.
So, have a good night. Let's have the ball time really each and every day.
Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring this podcast. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System, you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. At hundreds of locations across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's unifiedhealing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE System.